Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox chats with someone from the Arbor Day Foundation about the upcoming holiday that celebrates trees. He'll also talk with the author of a book on how to work with complicated people. And he'll talk with an expert who says it's possible to make the upscale affordable. Plus, Angela Ann is in for Doug Petcash of Face the State with a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Friday, April 25th is Arbor Day here in Columbus, and the holiday itself dates back to 1872, when an estimated 1 million trees were planted in the state of Nebraska alone on the very first celebration day. Dan Lamb is the CEO of the Arbor Day Foundation in Nebraska, curiously enough, joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Hey, Dan, the old saying of wishing to be a tree is applicable in Columbus, as the city has lost its federal reimbursement for tree planting and has to turn to private sources to fulfill its mission. How does that strike you?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's never been a more important time for trees, and we know there's all kinds of shifting going on with priorities in Washington, D.C. What I can tell you, Jay, is that what we're still hearing is a great amount of momentum and support, especially from the private sector, from individuals to be planting trees. And we continue to be excited about working with the U.S. Forest Service and making sure projects get done in cities and towns.
Tell me a little bit about the Arbor Day Foundation mission.
We're actually the largest nonprofit organization in the world dedicated to planting trees. And our simple mission is we inspire people to plant, nurture, and celebrate trees. And we do that by helping to get trees in the front yards and backyards and parks and cities and forest lands all around the world.
I like trees. I've always liked trees. I especially like shade from trees on hot summer days. But it's more important than just, you know, the shade issue or, you know, helping to curtail the wind. How do trees enhance the health of the community?
Well, it's a great point, Jay. Trees are no longer seen as just a nice to have. They are a must have, especially in our cities and towns. They are these wonderful natural air filters for us, helping to clean our air to create healthier communities. But to your point, they also, there's so many layers to the benefits. They help to bring shade to us, reducing our daytime temperatures on hot summer days by up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit, creating cooler and safer communities. They help to capture and slow stormwater runoff to reduce flooding in our cities. There's just so many positives by planting trees, and that's why we are always excited to get to be a part of helping the people get their hands dirty and get trees in the ground.
Can we also have trees inside?
You can. Absolutely, you can have trees inside. And there's more and more research that talks not just about how important trees are to make people happier and healthier in near green space, but the same kind of research is showing up inside, having inside green space, if you will, indoor plants and trees and shrubs. People just love being near trees and green, and that's why we love our work at the Arbor Day Foundation.
Every year here in Columbus, the city plants trees. And for years and years and years, they got tons of federal reimbursement for that. That's not going to happen this year. Columbus City Council said earlier in the month of April that they will allocate up to $40,000 for trees. But the city has to go to private partnerships and individual donors to make the tree planting a reality. Now, here in Columbus, there's a Columbus Subaru dealership that's participating. And not just in Columbus, but all over the state of Ohio. What's the partnership with Subaru about?
So, well, unfortunately, we across the United States are losing tens of millions of trees every single year because of disease, age, extreme weather. And if ever there was a time to be planting trees, now is that time. So we are so excited to be working with Subaru as a part of their Subaru Loves the Earth initiative to plant and distribute 100,000 trees all across the country in cities and towns. And it's going to be super exciting for more than 600 different retailers are helping us distribute these trees, including in and across Ohio.
When folks want to find out how they can participate in Arbor Day or just in the tree or the green movement in general, where do you send them?
Anyone who wants to participate in the Subaru Loves the Earth initiative can go to the website at Subaru.com/earth, enter their zip code to find out which local retailer they can engage with and how they can reserve a tree. Further, anyone who just wants to learn more about trees and how they can plant trees, how to care for the trees they're planting, can go to the Arbor Day website at arborday.org.
Where are you guys going to get your money from if you lose federal funding?
You know, the Arbor Day Foundation doesn't rely on federal funding. We have got hundreds of thousands of members across the country. We work with great corporate partners like Subaru and others, and also private foundations. But I'll tell you what, Jay, it's never been a more important time for our work. Again, trees are not just a nice to have, they are a must have. So we are engaging with public, private partners to make sure we keep planting trees because the cities and towns we work in need them and our forest lands need them.
Dan Lamb's the CEO of the Arbor Day Foundation. Thank you so much for your time today and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Last year, the Columbus metro area had over 1.15 million workers. Did you know that 78% of working Americans say they personally deal with complicated individuals at work weekly or more often? And that almost half of American polls say they take a slightly lower paying job just to not have to deal with those people? Best-selling author and leadership coach Ryan Leake is with us today, and he says dealing with it could be your superpower. Hi, Ryan.
What's going on, Jay? How are you doing today?
Everything is everything. And in your book, Complicated People, you talk about adapting in stressful situations and that there's actual power in them. Who doesn't deal with complicated people in any facet of their life today?
Oh, that's right. Well, you know, I think we all would love to have a stress-free life with stress-free people at a stress-free office where everybody brings us our perfect cup of coffee and they're just acquiescing to all of our preferences, but that work environment doesn't exist.
And that's too bad, because if you found it, I'd be signing up.
Exactly. But here's the deal. If that environment existed, we wouldn't grow in that environment. We only grow when we're faced with challenges. And yes, sometimes those challenges are at the desk next to us, and those challenges are people. But when we can learn to work with those challenges, work with those people, we actually get power because that's where we grow.
What constitutes a healthy disagreement between workers at the workplace?
Phenomenal question. I believe a healthy disagreement is when we can disagree without disrespect. It's one thing for us to disagree about something. It's another thing to where it starts to get personal. It starts to get volatile. I start to offend you. I start to name call. But a healthy disagreement is where I could say, hey, I disagree with you on this particular subject, Jay. However, I would still love to hear why your perspective is the way that it is. Tell me your story. Let me get behind the scenes. How did you come to your conclusion? So I still respect you as another professional while still disagreeing with you.
Now, that works with co-workers who are at your level, but what happens if you end up in a situation where one of your supervisors is the other person? How do you handle it that way?
Phenomenal question. One of the things that we talk about in my book is speaking your leader's leadership language. Every leader has a value system, and you can decode their leadership language by understanding A, what they complain about, B, what they celebrate, what are the things that they're always going, I love it when they might celebrate a people story, or they might celebrate sales. And then the third thing that you want to pay attention to is what they champion. What do they put money behind? What are the things that they're championing? Well, when you understand those things, you can bring something that perhaps you're like, man, I disagree with them on this, but I know what they value. So I want to make sure that I cloak whatever conversation I'm trying to bring to them in what is very, very important to to who they are. And so, hey, I might disagree with them on a particular policy, but I'm going to say, hey, here's why I disagree with them on this particular policy. Because of this thing that you champion, it's going to lose because of this policy. Well, if you cloak it in that, you're going to have a much more effective way of collaborating with that boss. And the key word there is effective.
And that's true, because it's not a personal attack. It's more of a let's collaborate to do this better and cause no harm.
Absolutely.
So today, in 2025, a lot of workers have inherent fear that they will either be fired or laid off, either because of economics or government policies or whatever. How do you get a conflict-avoidant employee in that situation to take the radical leap and make the culture change in the office?
I think they have to be able to take ownership of their own career path. Sometimes what we do is we say, man, I want somebody else to do something for me. No, I want to take ownership of the way that I show up at work, the kind of person that I'm going to be. Here's the deal. I'm going to show up to work and I'm going to give my best. I'm going to bring my best attitude. I'm going to choose joy every single day. I'm going to bring my best ideas. I'm not going to give 80%. No, I'm going to give 100%. Why? Number one, you never know who's watching. You never know who you're selling to. You never know who you're working with that might lead to your next job. Well, you don't. If you're giving 70% right now, and then all of a sudden you want a recommendation from your current boss who you're not working that hard for in the first place because of fear or whatnot, well, they're not going to give you a great recommendation. But I'm a fan of saying give your absolute best wherever you are, because somebody is always watching.
Isn't that the truth? We say that in sports all the time. You never know who's in the stands.
Yeah, that's right.
So I absolutely loved the book. I found it to be a very quick read and very engaging. But as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, okay, I see this from the perspective of the employee, but in what ways can the employer address not just employees, but problems that come up? For example, changes in federal policy, having to adjust the budget, having to make cutbacks that are not popular. How does that individual deal with that?
Well, part of it is having great empathy. You know, you have to remember what it was like to be just an employee in an organization long before you were a leader, where, like you just mentioned before, you've got fears, you're not sure where you stand in the organization. And so I think remembering what it was like to be them can help you communicate at a much higher level, communicating with clarity, transparency, and even some vulnerability to be able to say, hey, there's some changes that are coming. There are some economic headwinds that, you know, we can't always see coming. But I understand. There's some research where it says that if a leader simply can recognize what an employee is losing when it comes to change, that employee, just that recognition, they'll get back to work immediately.
Well, I'm a retired manager, and I have advised younger managers who are doing it now to tell the truth. Don't make promises that you can't keep.
Absolutely. No question about it. And that's what happens, is you kind of start beating around the bush sometimes because you don't want to have to deliver bad news. But I think the more you can be direct with your employees and the more you can just be honest with them, they're going to respect you. They may not like the message, but they can still respect the messenger.
The book is available for sale. Where can we find it?
Amazon and RyanLeek.com.
And what number book is this for you? Because you've written quite a few.
This is book number 3.
Congratulations on your success. Like I said, an excellent read. And How to Work with Complicated People, author Ryan Leek. Thank you for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
Columbus is now the largest city in Ohio, and Franklin and Delaware counties are among the fastest growing in the state. One problem that the Central Ohio community is facing is housing, or a lack thereof. A bigger problem is affordable housing. Most equate affordable housing with the terms low income and high crime neighborhoods. Alexandra Both from Rent Cafe says that's not necessarily the case, and joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss affordable upscale living in the capital city. Welcome, Alexandra. How are you?
Hi, Jay. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How do you define the term upscale living? What does that mean?
So in a few words, upscale living means living in a high-quality apartment located in a good area, a nice neighborhood. For one of our most recent reports called Luxury for Less, which focuses on zip codes where renters can find deals on high-end apartments in nice neighborhoods, we used data from our sister company, Yardi Matrix, and used their building and location quality classifications. So specifically, we included apartments in buildings classified as A and B in terms of quality, and similarly, we included locations rated as A and B, which are the top categories for quality. Now, what does this mean? So, for example, high-end apartments are usually spacious with higher than standard ceiling height, private balconies, hardwood floors, with washers and dryers, or at least washer-dryer hookups, upgraded kitchen appliances, and more. In terms of location, we're talking about places with high-quality employment, shopping, entertainment nearby, with public transport availability, access to a freeway. Also, great views of mountains, lakes, or oceans score great points here, as well as a well-maintained neighborhood environment.
All right, I got to ask this question because this sounds like a dream come true in Columbus, Ohio. The average rent in Columbus is somewhere north of $1,400 a month. What is considered affordable in your study in Columbus?
So for the purpose of this study, we considered as affordable luxury the rates that are below the citywide average for high-end apartments and which don't go above the 33% rent-to-income ratio. This is the standard benchmark for affordability. In other words, in our report, we highlight zip codes that offer high-end apartments at below average rents that don't exceed one-third of the zip code and city's median income. These were labeled as luxury for less zip codes. Just to help you get a more a clearer idea, the median income in Columbus is now about $65K, so that's about $5,400 per month. Less than $1,800 per month,
okay.
Something like that.
When we talk about less than $1,800 a month, in Columbus, Ohio, that typically does not mean high crime areas. So what were some of the zip codes that you found that qualified in that, you know, less than $1,800 a month luxury rate?
So actually, we had another criteria that I already mentioned. The average rent in that zip code also had to be below the average rent for high-end units in Columbus, which is $1,642 per month, $1,642 per month. So we found four affordable luxury zip codes in Columbus. The first is 43230 around Gahanna, close to the John Glenn Airport. In this zip code, renters would be able to find high-end units that are typically around $170 below the citywide average for high-end units. So for each of these zip codes, we have calculated this difference, this gap between the zip code average rent and the citywide average rent for high-end units.
Give me an example of another zip code in another part of Central Ohio.
43235 is another zip code on our list. It's in Northwest Columbus. And here, renters would be able to find apartments that are $120 below the citywide average rent for high-end units.
And what is that rent in that particular zip code in Northwest Columbus?
So they have a pretty good chance of finding good quality apartment here, which meets at least some of the factors that I've mentioned before. And that's because there's a pretty good share of high-end units here. About a third of apartments in the zip codes that I mentioned are classified as high-end. And the area also has a good rating. So it's A and B, like I've mentioned before.
How frequently does the data change?
I mean, I'd say it's hard to say because it depends on a lot of factors like income, rents, construction of new apartments. We will revisit this analysis that we did, and it did gain a lot of traction for renters because it talks about deals for high-end apartments. And I guess we'll see over time how the figures change and how the results change.
Alexandra, both from Rent Cafe, thanks for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Angela Ann from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
The May primary is almost here. Thanks so much for joining us this morning for Face the State. I'm Angela Ann. Doug is off. Well, the primary during an off year typically has low voter turnout and often goes under the radar. But this year, there are several levies on the ballot that will determine how much you pay in taxes and where those dollars are going. Plus, there is one statewide issue on your ballot, and that is Issue 2. Issue 2 would authorize the state to allocate $2.5 billion over 10 years to fund public infrastructure projects. That program, funded with bonds, meaning your property tax bill will not change regardless of the election result. If it passes, Issue 2 would take effect immediately. So to tell us more about what is on the ballot and really the preparations underway right now, we are so glad to have Aaron Sellers joining us from the Franklin County Board of Elections. Aaron, good to have you with us as always.
Thanks, Angela. Nice to be back.
Well, let's talk about this. We're about a month out from the May primary. We just talked about Issue 2. What else will voters see on the ballot this year?
So because of State Issue 2, all 298 of our voting locations will be open on May 6th. So it is a full countywide. A lot of instances, like, for instance, my ballot is only one item on that ballot where I live. But other folks, depending on where they live, will have some things on their ballot. Columbus will have a city council race, a primary in District 7 that all voters in Columbus will be able to participate in. The Columbus City School Board has a primary. Whitehall has a primary in District Ward 2, mm-hmm. As well as some other areas. Then there's taxes, levies, school stuff that'll be on the ballot.
So it's really important for people to know that even if they say, oh, it's just one thing on it, you still need to come out. That's the statewide issue. But you'll have other things that are so local to you that will affect your life. So it's important to come out.
Yeah. The question I always get about off-year elections and, you know, why should I come out and vote in those? And obviously, a lot of the off-year elections have a lot of tax and spend issues. So right. So it's always important to participate in the process. If you've got something on the ballot, you should educate yourself and participate.
Traditionally, the turnout not as high as a presidential year. So what are you expecting for this May?
I learned long ago to not get into the prognostication of turnout, but it will be pretty light. I anticipate, if we get to 10% turnout, but hopefully, it certainly will be higher than that.
Yeah.
But with not a lot on the ballot, we'll see. But I hope that's not the case.
So is 10% voting and 90% complaining right after the fact? I'm just kidding. But let's talk about it then. Are there incentives or things that you guys have tried over the year at the Board of Elections to really encourage voter turnout?
Well, like doing things like this, to be out in the community and let folks know what's going to be on the ballot. I know the Secretary of State does things as well to try to get word out, public service messages, those types of things. Earned media is an important part of our thing that we do. But what we will be doing, and we've been doing this for several election cycles now, we will be mailing out things to every registered voter in the county to let them know, what's going on and when the election is and what's on the ballot.
I really like that flyer. What does it say? Know before you go?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really, it's just like a one fact sheet that you can just take with you.
Yeah. And those are things that we'll mail out to every registered voter in the county. I don't know if we household it or if it goes out to every registered voter.
We do want to remind people about absentee ballots because so many people, that is another option that people can do if they can't make it to the polls in May. You have to apply by April 29th, meaning you have to ask the Board of Elections where you live to have the application sent to you. But if you don't get it back in time by that postmark, what then?
So several years ago, the legislature changed a little bit of election laws to when you can request a ballot. And that has to be for this election cycle. April 29th is when you have to is the last day that you can request an absentee ballot.
So a week before Election Day.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
And that it makes sense. And I think it was a bipartisan issue because the old deadline used to be the Saturday before the election. We know that there's no way that somebody's going to get their ballot and get it back to us in 3 days. So that's that was certainly a good thing. Once the voter gets their ballot, as long as it's postmarked by the day before the election, they can mail that back to us. And as long as we receive it 4 days after Election Day, we can count that ballot. So it's the Saturday after Election Day.
Got it. And so if they don't postmark it, say, and I know you get this a lot, people walk in on Election Day with their absentee.
Yeah.
Then that's when they have to go to the provisional, right?
Well, if you have your ballot, if you have an absentee ballot, one, it needs to come to us at our office. You can't bring it into one of the 298 locations, unfortunately. You'd have to bring that to us.
And actual Board of Elections.
Correct.
Okay.
And we would need that by 7:30 on election night. And then what was the follow-up question?
If they aren't registered to vote by the deadline, which is tomorrow, but then they still want to vote, is there provisionals?
Yes. If a voter, we certainly won't turn a voter away from a polling location. We will offer them a provisional ballot. And those are handed out if the information that we have in our system, the address, doesn't coincide with their ID. If they're not in the system, if they have a name change, those are things that would institute a provisional ballot. There is a misnomer that's out there that provisional ballots aren't counted or they only count them in close races. That is certainly not the case. We have bipartisan teams that go through those to make sure that vote should be counted. So,
and let's talk about making sure every vote is counted because so many people question security measures and what you guys are doing. And I know a few years ago the county rolled out some, more secure voting machines, right?
Yeah, it's probably been four or five elections that we've got new voting equipment that's paper-based. From our old IVR machines where you actually voted on the machine.
Right.
So there is a paper component, and certainly I think it's gone very well for us.
Excuse me. Got a little tickle in my mouth here. Polling location changes. Will people expect any changes there?
Yeah, unfortunately, we always have a few locations that for whatever reason can't have us because of, construction, things of that matter. But yes, there will be, and any voter that has a change, we notify them by mail of that, and we'll have that on our website that folks can look at to make sure. The sample ballots for the May 6th primary are loaded on our website. If you want to see what's going to be on the ballot, we certainly encourage folks to do that, to see what's on it before they go. They can do that. They go to our website and they can actually look at what the ballot's actually going to look like.
Well, I know we're asking you a ton of questions, Aaron. I have a few more, though, because we know that this is kind of game time for you, right? Presidential election is like the Super Bowl. This is kind of May primary. What are you doing to prepare?
Yeah, so what I like to tell folks is whether it's a presidential election, whether it's gubernatorial, or an off-year election like we're in now, we do the same things every election cycle. We abide by the Ohio Elections Official Manual. And everything, what we did last year in November, we're doing the same thing right now. Mm-hmm. We've got folks in the office preparing all the machines that are going to go out to the 298 locations. They're putting the ballots on the machines, the logic and accuracy testing. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things that are going on. Our poll workers, poll worker department is busy reaching out to our poll workers to get them scheduled for training. Training is starting now. We've got youth at the booth. Whether it's for dog catcher or president, we do the same thing every election cycle.
And you are looking for volunteers, right? Always for poll workers.
Yeah, we're always looking for poll workers. We've got a very dedicated staff of poll workers. And again, as I like to tell folks, if we didn't have those folks, we couldn't do what we do. When we have a full countywide, our goal is to recruit upwards of 5,000 folks for those 298 locations. I think we're off to a very good start. I don't have percentages of what we have, but we are off to a good start. And we've got a very dedicated team that this is their job. This is what we do. We run elections. So
and to ramp up over the next 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what happens when those polls close. How soon will those votes be counted? And how soon can we expect to see results?
Yeah, so on election night, typically stuff starts coming back to us after the polls close at 7:30. Mm-hmm. We're a hubbub of activity out at the board. Probably about 8:20, folks start bringing supplies back to us. It's busy for a couple of hours, folks bringing stuff back. It's always our goal to get the unofficial results back before. We certainly would like to have it by the 11 o'clock news. Generally, we hope to do it before the end of the day. Sometimes in big presidential cycles, sometimes it takes a little longer.
Sure.
I anticipate this cycle that we should have unofficial results hopefully by before midnight.
Well, we have your cell phone, so we'll be calling you because we're on every platform, streaming, 10TV Plus, online. So we want it right when they come in.
The hotline.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of talk right now because the real ID deadline is coming up May 7th, which is the day after Election Day. But so many people right now are changing out their identifications, right? And they're going to the BMV to get new ones. Let's remind people again what they need to know, what they need to bring with them ID-wise so that they can vote.
Yeah, so when you go to vote on election day, or if you want to come to our office where voting begins on Tuesday, you would need a valid state driver's license or state ID card. You can use a passport or a passport card, valid. If you're a military member and you have a military ID, those can be used as well. So those are the items, and this is several election cycles now. So I think most of the viewers are aware of what they need to do.
Yeah. Gone are the days that you can bring that utility bill. You don't have to dig that out because they won't take it anyways,
yes,
right?
Yes, that now is not a form of ID that we accept. Another one that I do want to mention is the state of Ohio now has a driver's license that you can have on your phone.
That's right.
As of now, that is not a legal form of ID that we can accept for voting.
Lots of great information. Aaron Sellers, thank you so much for coming.
All right. Thanks,
really
Angela.
Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
The County Board of Elections.
Thank you.
All right, let's run through some of those important dates once again for the May primary. Again, early in-person voting this week is from 8 to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. There is no early voting this weekend, but the polls open again Monday at the same time. Now, the last day of early voting is May 4th. That is a Sunday, with Election Day then on Tuesday, May 6th.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Ohio lawmakers introduced a bill that they hope will increase transparency for people who sign up for Medicaid. Here's why. Many people across the state are signing up and not knowing that they have to pay that money back. Then after they die, the surviving spouse is left with quite a bill that's a surprise. This is a story 10TV's Kevin Landers uncovered months ago. He joins us now on Face the State to talk a little bit more about this. So, Kevin, this is really jaw-dropping what you've been telling us. Just days ago, you were inside that hearing that talked about this, where lawmakers introduced this at the State House. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's called Medicaid Estate Recovery. What that means is exactly what you said. When someone passes along the bill that they receive from Medicaid, that has to be paid back. And a lot of people don't realize that. And what this bill would do is it would provide transparency. What that means is they want the bill to explicitly tell people that if you sign up for Medicaid, this is what you're going to have to do when you pass away. That bill for those services that were provided will have to be paid back to the state.
Okay. In February, you also reported on this issue. You spoke with a lot of people who received bill. How much money are we talking about here?
So people receive thousands of dollars in bills from the state of Ohio. And by law, Ohio can take your home, your car, to pay back the money owed to Medicaid. The bottom line is it can be expensive to die in Ohio.
Better communication builds trust between Ohio's government and its citizens. When people feel blindsided by the estate recovery claims, it can lead to frustration and distrust.
And he told me, like everybody else knows, it's free. So I was on it for a year, and then my friend Bob Weldon let me know that, did you know that there's a estate recovery, that if when I die, that they're going to ask for those premiums back through my estate? And I said, no, I did not.
Plus, one other thing to note, Angela, the bill does have bipartisan support.
So clearly, everyone seems to be on board with saying we need more transparency, because that's the last thing a family wants to deal with, is a bill when you're dealing with grief of
right.
the passing of a loved one.
Right.
Okay. So what will happen then if this bill passes? How soon, and what will we actually be able to see?
Well, it's right now in the committee stage, so they haven't voted it out of committee yet. They're going to have opponent testimony coming up next week, so we'll hear that. And then after that, we'll see what happens. But at this point, it's still in its infancy. This actual bill was proposed in the last General Assembly. They didn't have enough time. This time, they're hoping that it's been tweaked, that it's been written correctly, that they have the votes to pass it out of committee and then hopefully get to the House floor.
And will there actually be something on the bill that will say, like, exactly this is what you owe us?
Right. They want the bill to say exactly before you sign up and after you sign up, that you know exactly what you're signing up for. One thing they don't have in this bill, and one of the people who have been pushing for this bill wanted, is they wanted to ensure that people who sign up for Medicaid estate recovery or Medicaid benefits, that they actually have to sign the paperwork. And oftentimes, which is surprising, is people don't have to sign up for Medicaid. People could just verbally say they want it.
Wow.
They actually wanted a line in the bill to say that you have to actually have to get a signature, but that's not in this bill.
And it only applies to people over the age of 55, right?
That's right. It does only apply to 55, and that's one of the issues people have, is why is that only 55 and over have to pay the money back? Those who are under 55 don't.
Right.
That's not part of this bill, but that's another bill, another question for another day.
Yeah. Another episode of Face the State, for sure.
Right.
All right,
right.
Kevin, thank you so much for reporting on that. It's certainly something that we will follow closely.
Yeah.
And, of course, as we talk about this, you know, there are many programs that really affect this situation. The bill, again, doesn't address what that has. So, Kevin, thank you again. We have other things that lawmakers are doing. House Republicans are proposing new changes that would impact how your child's school is actually funded. So this is all part of a new measure that GOP lawmakers want to add to the governor's proposed state budget. This change would require each county budget commission to identify when a school district carries over more than 25% of its operating budget. Now, for every percent over that mark, the commission then must reduce your property tax bills in the following year based on that amount.
But this is immediate relief that does not cost the state money. We're not going to shift tax burden from one set of taxpayers to another.
Plus, fears of state funding cuts are now trickling to local libraries, where an amendment to the House's proposed budget could cut $100 million from the public library fund. So the Columbus Metropolitan Library is now asking supporters to reach out to lawmakers. Here's the letter from the library CEO that was sent out last week. It explains how the library system relies on state money for things like school help centers and adult education resources. Here's what Representative Brian Stewart said about that funding when it was first proposed.
With regard to libraries, we are going to transition away from this kind of set 1.7% and go towards a flat direct appropriation to our libraries.
Now, Columbus isn't the only library system that is speaking out about this. Bexley Library also asking voters to tell their representatives to vote against this funding cut. Also, in the House version of the budget, we learned lawmakers talked about how your money could help build a new Cleveland Browns stadium. This would be for the proposed stadium in Brook Park. The state has been asked to issue $600 million in bonds for that project.
I point out this is in many ways, to my mind, is like a loan. The team has given, I think, very reasonable metrics on what type of increased economic activity is going to be associated with this project.
House Speaker Matt Huffman says they hope to pass the state's proposed budget sometime this week. But we have a heads up about a new law taking effect this Wednesday. It changes how landlords can move forward with housing-related lawsuits. This law protects Ohio renters from lawsuits that are often filed to intimidate or punish people for expressing their opinions. Well, this means now that if you write a negative review about your landlord or your living conditions, you will have stronger legal protection. But keep this in mind, that does not mean every lawsuit will be dismissed. Meantime, multiple bills about sub-metering are making their way through the State House. The practice is popular at condos and apartments where third-party companies bill people for their utility usage without supplying it. One Ohio House member is trying to regulate these companies. He says this could save property managers a lot of money.
The biggest gaps are essentially this is an unregulated market. The PUCO, and from the state perspective over what even is, sub-metering, how is it treated by the state, who oversees the billing process, for example, or to make sure that it's being spread among the correct tenants.
These bills are currently in the early stages of moving through the State House, so we'll, of course, keep you posted with the progress.
Again, that's from our sister station, WBNS-TV, and the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS-FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.